The Tom Woods Show, episode 1366.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Let's talk about court packing today. This is a topic that's in the news because, as I predicted on this podcast, the Democrats are not simply going to say, well, I guess we've lost the Supreme Court. Of course, under Trump, we've had Gorsuch and then Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh not being a lot of people's first choice for a number of reasons, but nevertheless, there's still a move to the right, at least toward some kind of originalism in the court's jurisprudence under Trump. And then, of course, there is the possibility that Trump may appoint yet another Supreme Court justice. So it seemed to me that given how significant a role the court can play in American life, that it was highly unlikely that the left, and I realize the left and the Democrats are not the same thing, or they're not coterminous, let's say, but it's as close as we can get in American politics. And there was no way that the left, whose goal is just ongoing revolution, was going to let this institution, which represents a major block to some of their plans, no doubt, just fall into the hands of people who are not in sympathy with them. There was just no way they were going to sit back and let that happen. And I said, there is going to start being talk of packing the court again. And by packing the court, I remember I have about 17% of my audience is not from the United States, so you may not know the term, but it just refers to expanding the Supreme Court to accommodate more justices. So right now, the court consists of 9 justices, but you could conceivably expand that number because there's nothing that limits it to any particular number. Or at least there's nothing in the Constitution that limits it to any particular number. What we've had is, at the very beginning, under the Judiciary Act of 1789, we had 6 justices. Then we got the number up to 10 by statute. That was under Lincoln. Then the radical Republicans did not want Andrew Johnson, who was Lincoln's successor, to be able to make any appointments. So they actually lowered the number of justices down to 7. Then it popped back up to 9 again before the 1860s were finished. And that was the last time it was changed. It has stayed at that number for 150 years. So it doesn't have constitutional status, but in the minds of some people, it has quasi-constitutional status by virtue of its longstanding, of, you know, it being the number of longstanding. But at the same time, obviously, it could be changed. There's nothing stopping it, strictly speaking, from being changed. And so, as I say, we're now starting to see talk of that happening. So let's say a couple of things first about the history here, and in particular, why don't I say something about what happened under Franklin Roosevelt? Because that's what we refer to as the court packing scheme in American history. What happened there was, in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt introduced what became known as the New Deal, his programs designed to lift the United States out of the Depression. But then also, in the so-called Second New Deal, he had more permanent programs that he thought would have more long-term consequences. So in other words, in the first New Deal, you had more immediate programs that nobody really expected to go on forever, like the National Industrial Recovery Act, for instance. But then you had more lasting things. Like, for example, Social Security came about in the second New Deal. But the point is, what began to happen was the Supreme Court would strike down New Deal programs. So they struck down the National Industrial Recovery Act for good reason, of course. The amazing thing is how they didn't strike down more of it. The Agricultural Adjustment Act, major features of the New Deal, were facing real constitutional difficulty. And it's worth noting in my book, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask, in the chapter on Social Security, it's interesting to see the different rhetorical contortions they had to go through to describe Social Security in a way that would pass constitutional muster, they hoped. Franklin Roosevelt had gone out of his way to say that it was an insurance program because there was a stigma associated with welfare programs, if you can believe that, and he didn't want to run into that problem, that kind of resistance from the population. So he described it as an insurance program. And the insurance industry had a fairly good reputation in people's minds. It had come through the Great Depression actually fairly well. So people still looked upon it favorably. So he wanted to associate his program with something that people held in relatively high regard. And when there was some concern that maybe, well, wait a minute, we do have to deal with the court potentially after all, because they feared that the Supreme Court might strike down the Social Security Act on the grounds that the federal government has no authority to enact an insurance program, was to suppress the insurance language and to make clear that it was not really an insurance program, that there is a taxing portion and there's a benefit portion, but there's no express link between them. It's not like you're paying into something that then pays out to you. They wanted to make these things quite distinct. And one scholar of the subject says that administrators believed it was imperative to keep the language sufficiently opaque. And this continued, by the way, into the 1950s and all the way up into 1960. There was a Supreme Court case, Fleming versus Nestor. And in that case, the government was afraid that if they portrayed Social Security as insurance, that the court could strike it down, saying that the federal government has no authority to implement an insurance program. So they just came right out in their brief, the government's brief, and just called it a tax. And they actually said it is in no sense a federally administered insurance program under which each worker pays premiums over the years and acquires at retirement an indefeasible right to receive for life a fixed monthly benefit, etc. They expressly contradicted themselves as a way of making sure that the program survived the Supreme Court's review, which of course it did. So that's Fleming versus Nestor, 1960. I just mention it because it's interesting to see that even at that late date, there's still an effort to make sure that things are worded so as to pass any potential constitutional test. So even like the national highway projects of the 1950s were portrayed as a national defense measure. Because if there's a nuclear war, you see, well, we can just drive our cars out onto the highway and we'll all be able to evacuate efficiently. Anyway, getting back to Franklin Roosevelt. So he gets frustrated with what's going on with the court and the New Deal. So initially, 1936, he's reelected, and he has massive, massive Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, absolutely lopsided. In the House, it was 334 to 88. And in the Senate, can you imagine the Senate being so lopsided? 74 to 17. Absolutely unbelievable. And so he thought, with that kind of, you know, and he himself won a landslide reelection victory. So he thought he was more or less invincible and that now he could go ahead with hammer and tongs and get to work on the Supreme Court. So he announced that he intended to expand the court, and it was that for every justice on the court above age 70 who did not retire or resign, he could add one additional justice. And this would mean, because six out of the nine were over 70 at that time, that he could add as many as six more justices to the court. And the way he initially portrayed this was not to say, well, these justices are holding up my programs and I've got to stop that. Instead, the way he portrayed it was, oh, these elderly men need some extra help. And so we'll add more. You know, you could say insensitive things like that in those days. These are old men, they need some help. So I'm going to send them help in the form of more justices. That was how he portrayed it. But, you know, people were, come on, they were kind of wise to what he was doing. And eventually he became more forthright about what his intentions were. He said that in his view, the current state of the court was intolerable because it was wedded to an old-fashioned jurisprudence. And what we needed was a more flexible view of the Constitution. And that would allow, of course, his New Deal programs to continue without threat of being found unconstitutional, and he could continue to implement new ones. What's interesting about this is that there was overwhelming opposition to the court packing plan, including among Democrats themselves, FDR's own party. And it wound up being rejected. And I want to actually read to you, this is what the Senate Judiciary Committee said about it, the court packing plan. "We recommend the rejection of this bill as a needless, futile, and utterly dangerous abandonment of constitutional principle. Its practical operation would be to make the Constitution what the executive or legislative branches of the government choose to say it is, an interpretation to be changed with each change of administration. It is a measure which should be so emphatically rejected that its parallel will never again be presented to the free representatives of the free people of America." Well, I rather doubt that a lot of the Democrats proposing it today have heard that quotation. Not that that would stop them, but it might embarrass them slightly if they were capable of embarrassment. Well, anyway, the bill gets rejected, but nevertheless, FDR's intimidation of the court may have had some effect. We note, for instance, that Justice Owen Roberts suddenly becomes much friendlier in his decisions to what the administration wants. But also, it turns out FDR didn't even need the court packing plan after all, because he wound up getting his chance to influence the court the old-fashioned way, not through the crude manipulation of the court packing plan. He was able to fill 7 vacancies on the court caused by resignations, retirements, and death. So no need for court packing after all. And then, of course, with the new court, well, you get crazy decisions like Wickard versus Filburn, many of you have heard about from 1942. That's the case of the farmer growing wheat for his own use on his own property, but this was still called interstate commerce. And they try to justify that by saying that his homegrown wheat that he consumes for himself and that his livestock consumes, and these are the words of the court now, supplies a need of the man who grew it, which would otherwise be reflected by purchases in the open market. Homegrown wheat, in this sense, competes with wheat in commerce. So what they're saying is somebody who supplies himself with wheat because he's abstaining from purchasing wheat on the market thereby influences interstate commerce by virtue of his abstention from purchasing, and therefore he's subject to federal regulation. Well, obviously, under that standard, the government can get away with anything, which is indeed what it has been doing. Now, there's a very good article on this subject at the American Conservative by Bruce Fine, whom I got to know a bit during the Ron Paul days, and I remember chatting with him. Bruce Fine served in the Reagan administration, and he was a big Ron Paul supporter. And I remember I gave a talk on state nullification with him present. And I think we were sitting at the same table. And afterward, he said it was a good presentation. But, I mean, he was, of course, educated in, a traditional American law school. So he's not going to go for my presentation on nullification. But he also just said, as a strategic point, he just says, I just don't see it catching on. It just doesn't seem like a winner. It's too complicated for people to understand. And what I said to him was, okay, I grant you that the intricacies of nullification, like the constitutional arguments and the historical stuff, might be over the head of the average American. But the average American does understand what a middle finger means. And that's basically what nullification is, from the states to the federal government. I think they'll understand that. But anyway, Fine has an article, I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1366 if you'd like to read it, in which he talks about this newly revived idea of packing the court. And he makes the point that really the court is not nearly as insulated from public opinion as people think. I mean, we think of these judges as being these platonic, greater than the rest of us intellects on some mountaintop who are just dispassionately weighing the evidence. And he says it just doesn't seem that that's the case. He says that the Supreme Court follows the election returns. He says Democrats are losing the Supreme Court because their ideas are unpopular, not because of the number of justices. Should they prevail with the public, the Supreme Court won't be far behind. That's an interesting point. I mean, I'm not sure it totally holds, but it's an interesting point. So we'll come back to that in just a minute, because I want to go through just a few of the statements that certain Democrats have made and evaluate those. Before I do that, I'd like to thank some folks who have been a great sponsor of the Tom Woods Show and whom I am so proud to be associated with. And that is the folks at Skillshare. They now have 27,000 classes. Every single time I talk to you guys almost, it seems like the number of classes they have increases by 1,000 because they're always adding brand new content by exciting, really, really impressive instructors on a wide variety of topics that can fuel your curiosity, creativity, and career. It's an amazing service. You will find all kinds of topics ranging from entrepreneurship, technology, business, to design, illustration, photo and film, and writing. Millions of students are already learning on Skillshare, and you can join them today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. That's right, Skillshare is offering Tom Woods Show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 27,000 classes for free. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/woodsfree. Again, go to Skillshare.com/woodsfree to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/woodsfree. All right, let's go to an article on thehill.com. The headline is Warren Harris Gillibrand Back Efforts to Add Justices to Supreme Court. So what I'm reading here is from, first we'll start with Kamala Harris. She says, "We're on the verge of a crisis of confidence in the Supreme Court. We have to take this challenge head on, and everything is on the table to do that." So she's not ruling it out. And then Elizabeth Warren says, "It's not just about expansion. It's about depoliticizing the Supreme Court." Now that's amazing that she can say that with a straight face, because obviously that is the opposite of what she wants. What she would wind up doing is, of course, dramatically politicizing the Supreme Court. The thing that upsets the left about the court is not typically, I mean, every once in a while it is, I'll grant you, and sometimes the court does bad things. Sometimes they wind up being lackeys of the executive branch or, you know, they whatever, and I am as opposed to that as anyone. But by and large, it's not that they think the Supreme Court is implementing right-wing policies or anything. Like they're not implementing, you know, they're not constitutionally mandating abstinence programs on the whole country or something like that. That's not what they're upset about. Generally, what they're upset about is inaction by the court, that the court is simply letting people decide controversial questions on the local level and they're not intervening. The left wants them to intervene. They want one pattern of life imposed on the country. So what the court is doing by not intervening is precisely depoliticizing itself. Is saying that let society manage these questions for itself rather than, you know, over 300 million people with many different value systems that are incompatible with one another being subjected to one rule imposed on them from Washington. So it's precisely when the court does not intervene that it is depoliticizing the situation. That's what it's trying to do. Whereas what Warren wants is a court that is much more activist, where the court is making political decisions, supposedly in light of the Constitution, but, you know, come on, let's don't make me laugh on that one. So then we've got O'Rourke saying, what if there were five justices selected by Democrats, five justices selected by Republicans, and then those 10 pick five more justices independent of those who picked the first 10? All right, people might say, oh, well, maybe that sounds fair. And incidentally, another member of Congress said, the court should not be a court that you can figure out who the Republican judges are and who aren't. That was a Democrat. Notice they don't say we shouldn't be able to figure out who the Democrat judges are. The funny thing is, half the time you can't figure out who the Republican judges are because they become like Democrat judges when they get on the bench. It never works the other way. And that lends support to Bruce Fein's theory that the justices are indeed influenced by public opinion. Because otherwise, wouldn't it be a 50-50 chance that a justice would be as likely to become more originalist, let's say, as opposed to becoming more flexible in interpreting the Constitution? But yet it never happens that the left appoints a judge and all of a sudden the person becomes Antonin Scalia. It just never happens. But yet you do see people get on the court and gradually drift. I mean, John Roberts, for example. There are some people up in arms about some of his decisions. So it only works one way. Now, why is that? Could that be because of public pressure? Could that be because they are swept along by the zeitgeist? They're not just these disembodied platonic spirits who are unperturbed by outside events? I don't think that describes reality. So that's it's on the table. The idea of packing the court is on the table, as I predicted it would be, and I was hoping to be proven wrong. I love being proven wrong. When I predict something horrible and it doesn't happen, I say, phew, okay. But this indeed is happening. Now, what Fine says that I think may carry the day is this. He says, Democrats are absurdly crusading for court packing to alter decisions rendered and anticipated by the Supreme Court under the stewardship of Chief Justice John Roberts. Court packing would transform constitutional law into a jumble of political calculations with ulterior motives. It would shake public confidence in the administration of justice and cripple separation of powers, a structural Bill of Rights, by making the Supreme Court an appendage of the political branches. Moreover, the public is unconvinced of the wisdom of court packing. At present, it holds the Supreme Court in higher regard than either the presidency or Congress. And incidentally, there is a group called Pack the Courts. You can find them at Pack SCOTUS. SCOTUS stands for Supreme Court of the United States. PackSCOTUS.org. And you'll see it. And you go there, and the homepage doesn't say much. It says Pack, period, the, period, courts, period. Okay. And then it's got two little paragraphs, and then you have to click on their press releases or their news link, which just takes you to some articles about why we ought to pack the courts. But here's how they describe it. If you want to build a democracy that works for everyone, you must have an honest judiciary. But for the past generation, the Supreme Court has been a political weapon for the billionaire class. All right, so demonize the court that way. All possible things you could say. The controversial confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh makes the power of that political weapon permanent. Unless we act under a new administration, the integrity of the judicial system will be lost, and with it, faith in democracy itself. Our mission is to urge Democrats to restore the integrity of our courts by expanding the size of the lower courts and adding four seats to the Supreme Court after regaining control of the White House and Congress, hopefully on January 20th, 2021. So that's what it says. So unless we obviously politically influence the court, the integrity of the judicial system will be lost. And then with it, faith in democracy itself. And here they are dealing with, they're talking about the most undemocratic branch of the government. So if what they care about is democracy itself, I don't even know why they would have a court. Why wouldn't they just say, Democratic majorities will decide all these questions? So who even knows? I think this is just a bunch of boilerplate that some intern wrote. But that's up there, packscotus.org. I don't know if there's any money behind it. I don't know if it's just a website, but Fine mentioned it in his article, so I went and took a look at it. So I'll link to that also at tomwoods.com/1366. That's being proposed, folks. And let's hope that one. I mean, geez, how do you keep up with these people? It's pack the courts. It's the Green New Deal. It's one crazy thing after the other. But, you know, as Jeff Deist says, can't beat something with nothing. And if our response is just, no, don't do that, no, don't do that, I don't know. I mean, we're going to need something a little bit better. And I don't mean we have to come up with our own crazy scheme, but we got to explain ourselves as not just being no, but what we favor, what we support, what's the society that we want. What's that going to look like? What does it look like? What's appealing and attractive about it is something we got to bear in mind. All right, folks, we're going to wrap it up there, but I want to tell you about a really, really very nice website created by one of my listeners, and it's serenity-design.com. And the woman who runs it says, I blog about cultivating a beautiful home from a perspective of personal freedom, resourcefulness, and gratitude. I hope to inspire my audience to come up with solutions for bringing beauty, order, and delight into their homes. I also make and sell home accessories on the side. And it's just a wonderful site with such a diverse array of posts, and it's just beautiful. I love the whole idea behind it. I love the content. Wonderful. And I hope you agree, and I hope you'll check it out. It's different from a lot of the sites that I promote. It's a completely different theme, but definitely worth a glance and worth our support. So please check it out at serenity-design.com. I'll link to that also at tomwoods.com/1366. And don't forget to get started on your own little online project, because you know old Woods here will give you a nice publicity boost as long as you get your web hosting through my link, where you'll get an excellent deal. And you'll also get membership in my private bloggers group and other benefits that will help you hit the ground running and be successful with whatever your online project is. From the simplest libertarian blog to a flourishing e-commerce website, whatever it is, I'll be glad to let the folks know about it. So make sure and check out tomwoods.com/publicity for details on how to do that. And I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.